Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR Public Radio. When Dr. Nancy Fleming retired from Hendricks College as director of the choir and choral studies, it was my intention to have her successor join me on the art scene as soon as he or she was in town and ready. Dr. Andrew Morgan hits the ground running and is now in his second full year as Hendricks College choral conductor. And we've only just met. Largely my fault. He came a week or so ago to talk about the upcoming concert, a presentation of Karl Orff's popular Carmina Burana. And I seized the chance to find out about Dr. Andrew Morgan first, before exploring the Orff work. Andrew Morgan grew up in Minnesota in a musical family. His father had been a high school band director. He sang in choir in his growing years and knew early on that choral conducting had to be his chosen field, and so followed that particular star.
I think my years of singing and living in that experience from inside the ensemble has helped me as a conductor to shape and develop my ear and my sensitivity to what I want to hear when I'm on the podium in front of the group.
And then you went on to Renaissance and Baroque,
particularly. Yeah, early Baroque music was what I was studying in my music history degree. That was at Temple University, and I did a joint master's degree in choral conducting and music history. The music history was sort of a surprising part. That was an add-on. I went there to study choral conducting, and had a good connection with one of the music history professors who taught a research course that I took, and he could sense that I had a natural interest for music history, and he and I met and discussed the possibility of my adding music history, and it was accomplished with just one extra year of the program. So I studied specifically music from the court of Dresden in the early 1600s, and specifically, even more specifically, researched a composer named Vincenzo Albricci, who was Roman. There were a lot of Roman composers that were employed in this court. It was a Lutheran court, but one that had leanings, we shall say, towards Catholic music. A lot of Latin church music performed in that court. And I found a setting of a Te Deum that Albricci had written that had never been transferred into modern notation, and there was a researcher at Notre Dame in Indiana who had written a book about this court and the music that was going on there, and I contacted her, and she happened to have done extensive research in Vienna and Berlin in libraries looking at some of this music and had scanned endless copies of it, and she sent me scanned copies of two different versions of this Te Deum that were handwritten by music collectors in the 1700s, and they were riddled with errors, and I had to sit down and meticulously edit the entire work and then transfer it into modern notation. It was a fascinating process.
And you learn a lot.
You do. And you learn more mysteries about the music, too. I learned, one of the odd things that these two manuscripts, which were separated by several decades and separated by hundreds of miles, contained the exact same mistakes. They were both wrong in the exact same ways. And so somehow they had either been referring to each other's work or that they had been copied from the same parent source. But either way, neither of these copyists noticed that there was all sorts of problems with the work because they never bothered to fix it.
And nobody had used it to find out where the directions had led them astray, and it wouldn't be too easy.
In the end, it wasn't that great of a piece, but the process of looking at it was sure interesting.
Now, was that part of your work at Temple?
Yes.
So you were lucky you found somebody who could point you in a direction that nobody had been in before.
Yes, my advisor was Dr. Stephen Zone. He is a Baroque expert, specifically interested in the music of Telemann.
Yeah. Now, you got to the point where you were looking where to go next, and you said that you were quite surprised when your advisor suggested Hendricks. Because you'd always been
Big
camps.
So after Temple, I actually moved back to Chicago for a couple of years.
What did you do there?
Got married.
Oh, well, you did other things too, didn't
you? I taught elementary school, which is what I had done after my undergraduate degree. And I love working with children, and music education is wonderful and fascinating, but I'm also quite certain that it's not for me. I knew that teaching adults working with college students and doing music of that variety was of more interest to me, and well, so I went up to Minneapolis for my
doctorate. The size of the mind that responds, that the older students can catch more quickly what you're trying to do, mm-hmm. and they're much more on a par with the style and maturity of the people you're working with.
Yeah, it. I think a lot of it has to do with where my own interests musically lie, and the music that I want to work on is not the music that's necessarily going to resonate with small children.
Or even younger ones who've got mm-hmm. other things on their mind, like football. So from Chicago.
Chicago up to Minneapolis, and we were in Minnesota for 3 years, where I was doing my doctoral work at the University of Minnesota. And that was a 3-year program, which I finished in May of 2014 before moving down to Hendrix.
And as I touched on, you had something of a surprise mm-hmm. that your advisor suggested, mm-hmm. a small school.
Yeah, my advisor was Professor Kathy Romy. She's the director of choral activities at the University of Minnesota, and she's a very, very wise and exceedingly intelligent person who understands people and has a real knack for seeing where they will fit. Mm-hmm. And where their calling lies, and one of the greatest strengths of that program is helping its graduate students like me to better understand themselves and to realize where you could really make a difference. Mm-hmm. And she knew that I had always been varied in my interests. She knew that I was interested in more than just teaching choral music, but that I was interested in teaching music history and music theory and working in an environment where I could have relationships and colleagues that were in areas other than just music. And she really felt that a liberal arts college would be a strong match for my talents and interests. And Hendrix was the one, and it's worked out wonderfully.
So the new programs that I can imagine you'd come in and look to see what you had under your mm-hmm. under your fingers and mm-hmm. in front of you, you would have had some ideas for yourself to add to mm-hmm. and maybe freshen something, because mm-hmm. I think when you came, it was the 50th anniversary of the...
For the candlelight service, yes. for our annual Christmas program. Yes. That was one of the most wonderful things about coming to Hendrix is the fact that I was there to inherit a program that was already rich in its tradition. And working at a school that valued music and choral music specifically and had a history of that really has helped me in this transition. I feel like I am widely supported by my colleagues. I have student enthusiasm. I work with wonderfully smart and really insightful students that are just a joy. I'm very, very fortunate to be in that setting. In terms of what I've tried to do that's new, I in the last number of years, I've become really interested in working with composers. I feel that students who come into a music program, unless they've had that opportunity before, they sing pieces of music but don't necessarily have as much of an understanding of the process of what the composer has gone through, let alone that the composer is even a person that might still be alive, that they could meet and relate to and learn about. In studying the candlelight service before I started at Hendrix, I knew that it was modeled in part after the King's College service in Cambridge, and they've been commissioning a piece every year, and I wanted to try to incorporate some element of that at Hendrix, and the idea of a candlelight carol competition was one that I thought would broaden Hendrix's visibility, that would gain interest from composers very, very far away. And sure enough, we were fortunate enough to have our first winning composer be from London. So we have someone from the other side of the globe mm-hmm. who is now familiar with our program, has heard our students, and has written music for the Hendrix community.
Great.
And that will now go on. And mm-hmm. he's submitted it to Oxford for publication, and so hopefully it'll go out and more people will have the chance to do that music.
That'll be great. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking also that you've been here, is this your second or third year?
Second year.
And so some of these ideas that were germinating, mm-hmm. you're beginning to put forward, and this mm-hmm. is one that they've picked up on, and mm-hmm. you've been able to contemplate. But that's exciting, and because one of the things that I've noticed with several of the people that I've worked with, talk to about the programs that they work with and composers, and the new composers are on everybody's list. Mm-hmm. Names that I've never heard of mm-hmm. before, can hardly pronounce some of them. And you can see it. And Philip is very good at picking up these things. Mm-hmm. We've seen and heard some marvelous new works that give a thrill. And the most recent, of course, was this jazz guitar concerto. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered, there's something else, the choral or chorale that you've
The chorale. This is a newly organized group at Hendrix that I knew that I wanted to offer the opportunity to perform Carmina Burana to more than just the students that have auditioned for my choir. And there was interest from people in the community that I knew, other faculty members, other students. Students at Hendrix have a lot of competition for their time because they're academically very, very busy, and a lot of them pursue various volunteer activities, internships, research, athletics, student organizations. And so trying to get them in to an activity like choir, which rehearses 4 hours per week, which is for them is a pretty big time commitment, can be a challenge. And so having some other opportunity to get them in to sing I thought was important. And so I have a group of it's about 25 members who meet with me on Monday nights this semester. It's our first time that we've done this. And they have been rehearsing only Carmina Burana throughout the whole semester, while the Hendrix Choir has been doing Carmina Burana in addition to another program of Shakespeare texts that we did back in March. But these two groups, starting this coming Monday night, will rehearse together, and then we'll go into our dress rehearsal and performance for the following week.
Yes. This is something we need to address, because halfway through discussing your background in music history, you only went back to the Baroque and the
Renaissance.
Renaissance.
Yeah, and here we are going back to.
And I just was going to ask, what not earlier? And I wondered if you'd done any plain chant and the mystery plays that gave rise to theater in music.
Mystery plays I've not done. I've not done myself. With Gregorian chant, actually, when I was in my master's degree program at Temple University, studying methods for conducting Gregorian chant is one of the first things that we did.
So, mystery plays, one day maybe.
One day.
My guest is Dr. Andrew Morgan, in his second year as choral conductor at Hendrix College. He has given us something of his background, and now we hear about Carmina Burana and his reasons for this choice. So when you came around to thinking of bringing the campus together with a work, why did you choose it?
This is a really universally enjoyed piece. I think that a lot of appeal in it. Everyone knows O Fortuna, the bombastic opening and closing to the piece.
Orff got caught up in the interest of these medieval poets, the Goliard poets, who were a bunch of rascally students who were traveling around the European cities and villages and encouraging all kinds of vicissitudes and misbehaviors. And it has got probably the best drinking song in the whole of literature.
And in that song, everybody drinks. It is an itemized list of everyone, brothers, sisters, fathers, mothers, daughters, priests, sailors, criminals, servants.
The lot.
I've now been sending out a little email to the student body with a link to a funny video of misinterpreted lyrics to that, which is really, really funny, and has sort of become a favorite in my family. Actually, we watch it and laugh at that. But there's appeal to it. There's an immediacy of recognition, which I think goes a long way in selling a piece of music. But going past that, it's a dynamic work, which is really, really energetic. Orff, who practiced really and developed a method for music education before he had launched into this work, had a real knack for rhythm, and using rhythm and specifically ostinatos that would repeat as a means to help people internalize musical ideas. You see that in this piece, and I think that part of the reason that it is so successful with its performers and with audiences is because there are musical features in it, rhythmic ideas, melodic motifs that are catchy, that are likable, that seem intuitive, that seem organically human, because I think that's where a lot of his own musical philosophy came from, and why he thought that why children learn music best by playing rhythms and by improvising rhythms and by repeating them. And you see that in his music too. So I think that there's musical structures in it that a lot of people can enjoy. I think that the text, as you've said, which is wildly irreverent and funny and so different from what my students normally would expect when they see something that's largely in Latin. That's a big thing of it, at least with how I work with my choir and what I think about what I want them to get out of it. You know, here's a piece that they see in Latin, and when they see Latin, most of them would instantly assume that it's a sacred work, but this is anything but. anything but, which is even more ironic when we consider the fact that the texts for it were discovered in a monastery.
Yes, and had been long buried. Yeah. And the notes that I got would surprise me that it was from the 10th to the 15th century that these mm-hmm. Goliard poets mm-hmm. worked their way
yeah.
through the particularly female aspect of the people they met. When you decided to do this, did you feel you ought to clear it with the powers that be in the music department?
No, it had been performed at Hendrix before.
Okay.
There had been a history of doing this work. I don't know when, but talking with my department chair, Dr. John Krebs, who mentioned that this work had been performed before. He'll be playing piano. We're doing the version of this work that's for two pianos and percussion, which was arranged by one of Orff's students, but with Orff's blessing. So this version with two pianos, which Dr. Krebs will be playing, as well as Timothy Allen, our college organist and choir accompanist. Mm-hmm. So there was great enthusiasm from the start. Great enthusiasm.
Did you get to see the one that Bevan Keating from the UALR department did?
No, I didn't. I have some students that sang in it, though. Some of mm-hmm. my students that have been at his church did that work.
Yeah, because he does a lot of dramatization with his as well. He's a challenge, but once you get into it, I would think. What did you do with the first rehearsal?
I think we watched the Gopher Tuna cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
I played that as a way to get them to sort of pique their interest. This is one of those pieces where a number of the students will know the piece by name, Carmina Burana, but a lot of them won't know it by name. But once they hear that music, then they will. So starting with some way to get their attention in. When I introduce a piece like this, I take the first couple of rehearsals as a opportunity to get some of the music into their ears, to give them something tangible that they can hold on to, something that they can remember, not getting too technical at first with lots of notes about breathing marks and consonants and diction, but rather just establishing a sense of enjoyment with the music and a sense of familiarity with the music. So I think we did the first two movements, which link together, and then we did one or two of the pieces that are in Middle High German, which are from the middle section.
And that would have been an interesting chorus, contrast to what the Latin has.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the Romance languages, and even German is a Romance language in terms of its formation. It's one of the few that has the Latin type grammatical construction. And it's always fun to discover how many words in French and Spanish and Italian and German have connections to English.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of begins to widen their perspective mm-hmm. and maybe give them a taste to learn a bit more about the countries they visit when they have a chance.
It's such an interesting German that's used in this. It's this relic of modern German that is largely lost. People around Munich in Bavaria might recognize parts of it as sounding similar to Bayerisch, the dialect spoken around there. But it's very, very old. And my students, I have a couple of students who've taken a good amount of German. I actually have one German major who takes voice lessons with me. He doesn't sing in the choir, but I showed him the text and he was just scratching his head. It looks like German at times, but yet it's some of the letter combinations are completely different, and the grammatical aspects of it, the cases in the text are nothing like modern German anymore.
The pronunciation is different.
It's difficult.
But it's softer, isn't it?
Well, so the pronunciation guide that we are using is one that I received this actually from a former professor of mine, Matthew Mahaffey at University of Minnesota. He was another advisor of mine. And this pronunciation guide is based on the one recording of this piece that Orff was involved in. And Orff did not conduct it, but he worked in close collaboration with the conductor that did. It was an Austrian recording. I can't remember which orchestra it was. I haven't listened to it myself, to be honest. But he coached the conductor very, very clearly on how he wanted things pronounced. And so I suspect that it's fairly accurate if one is looking at authentic pronunciation of Middle High German, but I think it's very accurate if one is looking at what Orff wanted to hear. And so I think we're taking Orff's interests into consideration with this.
Whereas he seems to be the only begetter of this particular mm-hmm. piece, mm-hmm. then it's probably sensible to look what you can at
yeah.
the pieces or the influence that he had on what mm-hmm. he felt mm-hmm. was the way it should be presented. So far you've been all the way through it.
Mm-hmm.
And have you found that with the students, with the singers, with yourself, that there are certain that you heave a sigh of relief that it looks easier and it is easier, and yet it still feeds out of or into pieces that are not as easy? So you have to work on them a bit more often.
Yeah. It's a piece that has its challenges. One of the challenges, I think musically, it's not a terribly difficult piece. There's a lot of repetition. There's a lot of movements of it that are strophic in nature. There's a lot of ostinatos, so you have repeating rhythms, short melodic ideas that are very easy to grasp. But one of the challenges of it is just the volume of text. There are just so many words. And as we said, none of it's in English. We have Latin, which we're pronouncing with sort of a Germanic twist. We have Middle High German, and then some of the later solo parts for the soprano and the baritone are in Old French. And so one of the greatest challenges is just getting the students comfortable with the amount of words that they have to deal with. And so I try to structure rehearsals so that there's time that we zero in on details of precision and shaping and refinement, but there's also times of rehearsal that are really dedicated to repetition mm-hmm. and just getting practice in having them do it several times in a row, especially on the drinking song of In Taberna, which is very, very quick, and where we're itemizing all these drinkers in Old Latin is very challenging, not musically, but in terms of text.
But so does the rhythm help that?
It does. It's something that we don't have to worry about.
Yes.
There's a couple of tempo changes that he does in that movement where he rather he does his tempos, at least in this movement, largely as sort of terraced changes as opposed to accelerandos. There's one big accelerando at the end, but a lot of the tempo changes in this movement are from 120 beats per minute to 144, back to 104, back to 92. And so you have to make these changes very, very quickly. That can be challenging for myself as well as for the students. But once you're established in that tempo, it's very, very consistent.
Yeah.
Very, very consistent.
But it paints a lovely picture of just how widely around that particular part of the world these musicians traveled.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That they were all found in this one particular monastery.
Yeah.
Gathered.
Yeah. Multiple languages represented. So yes. clearly the writers had spent time in these other areas.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it is a great piece to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the sort of thing, and I don't know if it happens with you on campus, that you'll hear students sort of humming or coming out with something of their own bodularization of the text, just to help them remember which pronunciation, you know, and which words, mm-hmm. if they've learned them or if you've helped them understand what it is they're singing. Whatever you do in a different language is going to be a sort of thing that you need to do
mm-hmm.
because all too sadly, very few languages are taught in school now.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. if you can do it in music with conviction and enjoyment,
mm-hmm.
not only on your part for having chosen it, but for the students that you're working with, your enthusiasm would come through and they'll find pleasure in certain words. I loved singing in French. There was just something about French that the very different pronunciation relative to English and German. Italian is a breeze, but French has its difficulties, but it has
a beauty to it.
Yes, and there's a something, it's almost a physical satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
I can almost taste it when I sing in French, when mm-hmm. I used to sing in French.
There's one little line that the women sing. There's a song where they're singing to a shopkeeper and they're asking him to give them red makeup, essentially to make themselves look pretty, and they're trying to impress young men. But one of the lines in German is "Minne tot juhoch gemort," and I, for some reason, that line just the feel of the words I find to be very enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like the word "through." There's a writer, I forget his name. He used to be on one of the NPR shows. He was on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He's a comedic writer, but he was talking about the word "through" and how the word "through" literally travels through your vocal instrument, starting "through," and it moves up into the lips. And it's just a little things like that. Just enjoying the experience of languages.
Right, but really it has enjoyable. To be through, as in O-U-G-H.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be E-W.
Right. Right.
It has to have that.
Well, it adds that extra meaning because it's the adjective, the adverb of going, the preposition of going through.
Yes.
Something.
And no. Something that when you can visually see it in front of you as you're singing it or saying it, it becomes invested with something different.
Mm-hmm.
So this is now coming up on the, what's the date? The
28th of April.
28th of April.
Yeah. 7:30 p.m.
Then in Staples.
In Staples Auditorium, free and open to the public.
And how large is the group you'll be conducting?
Well, we will have the choir will be around 60. Not a massive choir, but they're mighty in spirit and sound, I assure you. And we have two pianos, six percussionists, one of which is a student at Hendrix. The other five are from UCA in Dr. Blake Tyson's studio, which is a great percussion program. And then we have three soloists. We have Mara Caldwell. She's a soprano, a friend of mine in Fayetteville. We have Daniel Foltz Morrison, who is a tenor. He's sung with opera in the Rock around this area. I did a project with him in the summer. And then Ferris Allen, the baritone voice professor at UALR.
That was Dr. Andrew Morgan, choral conductor at Hendrix College in Conway. The production of Carmina Burana is set for 7:30, April the 28th, in Staples Auditorium on the Hendrix campus. One performance only, free and open to the public. For more information, call Dr. Morgan at 501-450-1248 or email morgan@hendrix.edu. And an Art Hub special today. The Spring Ruth Allen Concert this week with two musicians from the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra, featuring timpanist Nick Diamond and violinist Meredith Maddox-Hicks. An unusual duo and program. Music by Sting, Brahms, Gershwin, and Piazzolla, plus a klezmer hit or two. Tuesday, April the 26th at 4:30 p.m. in the UAMS Hospital lobby. Free and open to the public. Also, Arkansas Rep's delightful musical, The Bridges of Madison County, closes May the 1st. And the Arkansas Arts Center Children's Theater, The Adventures of Peter Rabbit, runs through May the 8th. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR Public Radio.